From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump holds a listening session at the White House later today with people affected by the mass shooting last week in Parkland, Florida. The president tweeted yesterday that he wants to strengthen background checks. He also spoke about so-called bump stocks.
I signed a memorandum directing the Attorney General to propose regulations to ban all devices that turn legal weapons into machine guns.
This comes as dozens of Parkland students are in Tallahassee today asking lawmakers to go further and adopt gun control measures they believe could prevent another attack. 16-year-old Melanie Weber is one of those students. She survived last week's attack. We spoke with her earlier as she was heading to the Capitol. So tell me where you are right now.
Right now, we're outside the Civic Center in Tallahassee, and we're currently, I think we're going to walk to the Capitol building.
And how many people are there with you?
Student-wise, there's about 100 of us, and I'd say there's around 15 chaperones, and then a bunch of just other people who are involved. There's a lot of media here, and a bunch of other people who are involved in organizing this whole thing. They're all outside with us.
So what are you going to be telling lawmakers today?
Well, we're just going to be talking to them about our experience, and because recently the House voted down a bill that was going to ban assault weapons like AR-15s, and so we got a list of everyone who voted no. So the people who voted no, we're going to ask them why they chose to vote that way, and we're going to try to talk to them to try to maybe hopefully sway their opinion the other way to vote in favor of banning assault weapons like an AR-15.
Are you optimistic you'll be able to do that, though?
Kind of. I mean, I know it's really hard to change people's opinions, but I think if we just talk to, if we just share our story and we appeal to them from a moral standpoint, we may be able to get something done.
Are you encouraged at all by what's happening in Washington? President Trump coming out and saying that everybody needs to get behind better background checks?
Well, I actually wasn't aware that he said that, but now that I know, I am behind that.
So beyond a ban on assault weapons, what more would you like to see?
I would like to see stricter background checks, just because people as mentally ill as the shooter was shouldn't even have their hand on any type of gun, much less an assault weapon like that. So it's just our goal to also make sure that there are better background checks to make sure that the people who do own guns are responsible.
Were you close to any of the people who died at Parkland?
I wasn't close friends with any of them, but I did know some of them.
What's it been like the last week or so?
It still feels kind of surreal that something like this actually happened to me at my school. I was really upset. I still am. I'm angry, confused, like as to why me? Like, why did this have to happen in my community to the people at my school?
So you and your classmates, many of them, have made this long bus trip from Parkland to Tallahassee. How have you been able to organize all this?
Well, the main organizer, her name is Jackie, and I don't really know how she was able to put this whole thing together. I guess she just got in contact with people here in Tallahassee, with some senators, like Senator Book, and they helped us organize the whole thing.
I'm sure you've seen that some people in right-wing media are saying that you students are FBI plants trying to protect the FBI and that you're being manipulated by the Democratic Party.
No, that is 100% false. We were all there in the school. We all experienced it. We all lost people who were close to us. I think people tended to underestimate us and our intellectual abilities. And I think they're just surprised at how well-spoken some people are and how much action they're actually taking. So I think their only way of explaining that is, oh, they're actors. But I can assure you that we're not.
How concerned are you that this whole movement that's going on right now will fade away like it has after so many other mass shootings where nothing gets done?
Yeah, that actually has been a really big concern of mine. And we've talked about it. We've talked about how all other shootings, they were in the news for a week and then they faded away and nothing ever got done. But we want to make sure that that doesn't happen. We're doing everything in our power to make sure that it stays alive. Like we have the March for Our Lives on March 24th, which is a month from now. So we're really trying hard to make sure that this isn't forgotten about, to make sure that something actually gets done.
That's Melanie Weber, who is a 16-year-old who survived the Parkland shooting last week. She's in Tallahassee today lobbying lawmakers. Melanie, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem.
Well, it's been a rough winter for flu sufferers. The Centers for Disease Control says levels of influenza are on track to top the numbers seen at the peak of the swine flu epidemic in 2009. They've already exceeded the severe flu outbreak of 2003. More than 33,000 Americans have contracted influenza, and as of last week, the CDC is saying the outbreak hasn't yet peaked. One particularly disturbing figure, in the third week of January, slightly over 4,000 Americans died, and those deaths were related to the flu or complications from it, those 4,000. Joining me now for an update is Dr. Jeffrey Klausner. He's an infectious disease specialist and professor of public health at UCLA. Welcome, Dr. Klausner.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, can you tell me what you're seeing in your emergency rooms? It seems as if we've been seeing some very serious complications to the flu this season.
Yeah, well, in our emergency rooms here at UCLA, we've definitely seen an increase in people coming in with influenza-like illness, with pneumonias, with heart attacks, and a variety of different complications.
So what is it, though, that determines whether a particular flu season is going to be worse than average?
Yeah, well, there's a bunch of factors that go into the severity of the flu season. One is the influenza virus itself. Flu vaccine is very effective at the H1 type and very effective at the flu B type this year. But the H3 type, which actually is often the more serious type in terms of the type that causes more disease and more hospitalizations and more serious complications, the vaccine this year seems to be less effective against that. The CDC report was that for that specific H3 virus, the vaccine is only about 25% effective.
Does that help us understand why this particular flu season also seems to be more deadly than usual? Because, I mean, there was that one week, that third week in January, where we had 4,000 flu-related deaths in the United States.
Yeah, well, on a typical flu season, we do see tens of thousands, 36,000 deaths a year. So in a bad season, we may see 40 to 50,000 deaths. So we do know that influenza is deadly, and it may be because this season the vaccine is not matched very well and not working very well against this H3 type that we're seeing these increased rates of complications, hospitalizations, and deaths.
Should people who haven't been vaccinated still get the vaccine?
Oh, absolutely. H1, the vaccine works very well against. The CDC reports 67% efficacy. Flu B, which can be very dangerous, the vaccine is working about 50%. So, you know, we don't see the outcomes of when the vaccine works well. So it is preventing type 1 and flu B. People need to understand that in the hospitals, we are seeing emergency rooms being overwhelmed. We are seeing not enough hospital beds. And just this past weekend, I was actually on the heart transplantation service, and we have young people have heart failure waiting for a heart transplant because they got infected with influenza and were not vaccinated.
Oh, wow. So that makes me wonder, Dr. Klausner, when should people seek medical attention if they feel like they've come down with the flu?
So typical symptoms of the flu would be high fever, headache, muscle aches, fatigue. People have those symptoms that they should go to their doctor. There are very effective medications that can reduce the symptoms and reduce the consequences. Certainly if people have difficulty breathing or chest pain, then they need to go to the emergency room because those may be influenza related symptoms that are causing pneumonia or heart attacks, which are much more serious.
Hmm. Now, do you have a sense or do we have any indication of when we might see a peak to this flu season or even a decline in the number of cases?
We may be actually reaching a peak in the next week or two. I mean, time will really tell. But even if we are approaching the peak or passing the peak, it's still an important opportunity for people to get vaccinated. So the vaccine does work. And people should not only get the vaccine to protect themselves, but protect other people in their household, other people they may visit, grandparents and young children who may, you know, suffer more serious consequences from influenza infection.
Yeah. I'm just remembering just now that this is, what, the 100th anniversary this year, 2018, of the 1918 flu pandemic that killed tens of millions of people worldwide. So if we needed a reason why we should remain vigilant, that's it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S., we have about 40% of the population get an annual influenza vaccine. We'd like to get that above 80%. Unfortunately, people don't see the risk. People say it's inconvenient. There's also a myth that, people think the influenza vaccination gives them the flu. That's actually not possible. And then some people think the flu vaccine doesn't work, but on the population level, it works very well to prevent continued spread of infection.
Well, that's Dr. Jeffrey Klausner. He's an infectious disease specialist and professor of medicine and public health at UCLA. Thank you so much.
All right, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Our next guest is up for his third Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. Willem Dafoe was previously nominated for 1986's Platoon and 2000's Shadow of the Vampire. Now he's up for The Florida Project, which is out on DVD this week. Dafoe plays Bobby, the manager of the Magic Castle. It's a brightly painted but run-down motel on a stretch of highway just outside of Disney World. Bobby's job is made harder by three kids who are running wild around the motel. In this scene, he throws two of them out of the office for making a mess with their ice cream.
Okay, out. I warned you. One drip and you're out.
Oh, come on.
Out now.
It's going to melt outside.
Well, obviously, it's melting inside, too.
But Bobby.
Out. Thank you very much.
You're not welcome.
A scene from The Florida Project, and Willem Dafoe joins me now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
So how would you describe this film, The Florida Project? Because watching it, it almost feels at times like it's a documentary.
Well, it's the world of people who actually don't have homes, who are living temporarily, long-term, in budget motels outside of the amusement parks in Central Florida. We shot this film at an actual working motel. Hmm. It's a film directed by Sean Baker.
And actually, you spent some time with the manager of the motel, right, to get ready for this role.
That's right. Just to get a sense of his job and what kind of person comes to that job and just to get a sense of the world.
What did you learn from him?
Well, many things. I mean, initially I met with him just to see what kind of person he was, what, certain external things like how he dressed, how he presented himself, how he spoke. But I think the biggest takeaway from my initial meeting with him was how proud he was of his job and how he was very passionate about his job. Now, he seemed like a very sort of normal, not extraordinary, if I can judge like that, a working class guy. But he had this extraordinary love for the people. It was his community. And I think he was always walking this line between cutting people slack and being the authority on the property because he wants to keep his job and he wants to keep the motel going.
You come across in this film like a father figure to some of the people on the property. Does he as well? Did you get that from him?
Well, he's certainly protective. As I said, he really took pride in the fact that that motel, although it's a very modest motel and the people are really struggling, for him, it's a better place. So this beautiful kind of sense that he does his bit, he knows his limitations, but he does his bit to make his little world a better place. Now, mind you, as I'm working on the role, I'm not thinking about that. Huh. I'm really just thinking about being a good motel manager.
Hmm. All right, we have to talk about the kids at the center of this film. Brooklyn Kimberly Prince, Valeria Cotto, and Christopher Rivera. We've got a scene of the three of them exploring the motel. Let's listen.
The man who lives in here gets arrested a lot.
This woman in here thinks she's married to Jesus.
Oh, watch out for the water. Because guess what? I went to the hospital one time.
These are the rooms we're not supposed to go in. But let's go anyway.
What was it like to work with these kids?
It It was good. I mean, the setup was that they were really allowed to be kids. And even though there was a strong script and there's a very clear scenes, we know what has to be accomplished in the scene. Sean Baker, the director, knew very well that he had to give them a lot of room, because they're the we really see most of the film through their eyes, mm-hmm. and it was important for them to be free and have a kind of, you know, indulge them in a certain kind of chaos, let them be kids, to let them play. One of the things that we did is, you know, we really made, not only are we shooting at a working motel, so we've got all these people kind of telling us their stories and giving us a good feel of the world, but we're also creating a parallel world. I mean, the our roles on the set were kind of parallel to our roles in the movie. Bobby, the motel manager, the character I play, loves these kids, but mm-hmm. he also wants to wring their necks sometimes because they create a lot of problems for him. And it's, you know, there's that pretty much happens on set as well.
I want to listen to another scene from the film. This is your character, Bobby, talking to Haley, the mom of one of the girls, who's been having men visit her in her room, and Bobby insists that they register at the desk.
When I say register, I'm talking about ID. They got to leave the ID right there with me in the office.
You can't just not let me have guests. What gives you the authority?
What the authority? My job title, manager.
I have friends, though. I have a lot of friends.
Yeah, we all got friends. We all got friends. But this is a special rule for you.
Can you talk about the relationship there between you, the manager, and Haley?
Well, Haley keeps on giving me a hard time. She keeps on breaking the law. You know, she breaks my rules. She's late on rent. She's having... I just don't want... You know, I'm basically a guy that wants everything to run smooth. I want everybody to be happy. And Haley puts a lot of demands on me. I try to cut her some slack because I think I feel protective towards her. She's a very young mother. She seems sweet enough, even though she gives me a hard time. So basically, there's always a tension because I don't want to be played by her because she does have a pretty good grift. But at the same time, I want to cut her some slack. So that's an interesting relationship. You could say it's like a father or a big brother relationship, but I'm not thinking of that when I'm playing the scenes. I'm just trying to conflict, resolve, and keep my position because I'm probably the kind of guy that needs this job, and last thing I want to do is get fired because the cops are coming around too much.
And the actress here is Bria Venite, who was found on Instagram. This was her first film.
Right. And she's fantastic. She was all in. It was great working with her. I really enjoyed it. Sean, the director, you know, the role was good enough that he could have attracted many well-known actresses. But the way Sean explained it to me is he was following Bria on Instagram. And he was just struck with her, how she looked, how she acted, her tats, you know, all of that. He kept on going back to her and finally stuck to his guns and said, listen, have her come out here. Let me work with her, see if it'll work. And he was very happy with the rehearsals that they did and the audition process. So then she just came on board.
Are you on Instagram?
No.
Could be where you get your next role.
Okay, I'll have to remember that if it gets a little slow.
So The Florida Project is your third nomination for Best Supporting Actor.
Yes.
What is that like? What has this Oscar season been like for you?
Well, it's been – I'm very grateful. This is a small film, and I'm very grateful that I got nominated, but I also was a little disappointed that the film didn't get nominated – or Sean didn't get nominated, or some of the actors didn't get nominated. So I'm the sole, you know, standard bearer, whatever the word is, for this film. So that sweetens it for me. I mean, I'm representing the film, and it's a film that I think is very good. It's got authenticity, and it's, you know, about what's going on now. So it's an important film to me. So I'm happy to be able to be speaking about it, you know, in the context of the award season.
And do you prepare an expression for your face when they make the announcement, since we'll all be looking at you to see whether you're happy or upset?
No, you'll know if I don't. If I don't win, I'll be pissed. I'll tell you that right now. No, I'm joking. But, you know, you get in a competition and the most natural thing is it's not a competition, but it feels like one because people are anticipating. Some people are rooting. Some people have favorites that aren't you and all that sort of thing. So you try to avoid it, but you can't help it. You kind of get into the game of it all. And, of course, I want to win. And it would be good for the movie as well.
You've played over 100 roles. You've also acted in New York theater for years. Is there a role that you have not played that you really want to at some point?
No. I'm never attracted to roles. I'm attracted to situations and to people because the truth is you don't know what a role is until you do it. And a role is defined by many things, but the only thing you really know is where it sits in a story or where it sits in a adventure or where it sits in the relationship to a director's vision. And that is always what draws me, because if I see a role that I think, wow, this would be great, this would really be fun, or I really could do something with this, those are usually the roles that I won't surprise myself with. So I always try to find things that I have enough contact with it. I have enough interest. I have something about it that attracts me, but I don't know what it is. And the process of making the movie is finding out what it is. And actually, sometimes, even by the end of the movie, you may not know, but you went through an experience that will, you know, for an audience, mean something.
That's actor Willem Dafoe, who is up for an Oscar for his role in The Florida Project. Thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck at the Oscars.
Okay, thank you.
And The Florida Project is now on DVD. The Academy Awards will be held on March 4th.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. A new year has begun, and if you are setting new goals for your business, you need the right people on your team. And ZipRecruiter has transformed how you find them. ZipRecruiter posts your job to over 100 job boards with just one click, then actively looks for the most qualified candidates and invites them to apply. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Right now, listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Taxidermy has been around since the 1700s, but in the last decade, the art of preserving dead animals has been given new life. Across the country, communities of amateur taxidermists have sprung up. Stina Sieg of KJZZ in Phoenix went to a class where people tried their hand at the process for the very first time. And a heads up, this story isn't for the squeamish.
What's the very first step to reanimating a rat?
Oh, baby.
Oh. Choosing one.
Mine was a boy, I think.
Renee Harper cradles hers as though it's a sleeping kitten. He's small, white, and limp.
He's not there anymore. It's just a shell of what it was.
With her bright pink hair, bejeweled cat-eye glasses, and hearse parked outside, Harper may not fit your idea of a taxidermist, but to instructor Doug James, she fits right in with a new experimental wave he's seen sweeping through the taxidermy world, full of young people and women.
And the old generation is kind of looking at the young generation going, eh.
But not James. He's happy to teach whoever finds their way to this back room at a store appropriately named Curious Nature. In front of the class, he flips his rat on its back and touches his knife to its chest.
I put a little pressure, and I'm going to stop.
He cuts a fine line, then tears a delicate seam down the middle of his little rodent. Renee Harper does not look happy. As the class peels off the skins like wetsuits, there's this mix of wonder and wincing from the group.
It's kind of gross.
But not everyone thinks so.
It's amazing.
Jessica Hager has dark lipstick, dramatic eyebrows, and her own flock of taxidermied animals back at her home in San Diego.
People think I'm a little weird. And they're like, oh my God, Jessica, what's your problem? I don't have a problem. I just have a deer.
And a deer foot. And a mink. Okay, it's kind of creepy, Hager says. But she loves animals and sees this as a way to preserve their beauty forever. Curious Nature owner Mason Conway gets it, though he knows a lot of people probably don't. Like many in this new generation of taxidermy fans, he does not believe in killing animals for display.
So I don't want anything to die, but if it's already dead, and if some way I can use that and turn it into something educational or beautiful or a piece of art, you know, that's what we're all about.
Not that the metamorphosis comes easy. It takes the class hours, stuffing the insides with shaved wood and clay, threading wire through those thin rat limbs, replacing their eyes with black glass beads. At one point, Renee Harper needs to turn away. She gets on her phone to look at cat pictures.
Right there's my happy place.
But by posing time, she's back in the game. Harper names her rat Borax, after the fluffy white compound that's mounded like snow all over the table. Standing up straight, his arms out in front of him, Borax actually looks pretty peaceful, with a sparkly green scarf around his neck.
He's like come back to life.
Jessica Hager's rat has been reborn as Elsa, the Snow Queen, complete with an itty-bitty tiara. As she fills in Elsa's bald spots with glitter, Hager says she has a new respect for all the effort put into those taxidermied creatures back home.
This is insane. I love it.
And now, she has a brand new table centerpiece. For Here and Now, I'm Stina Seeg.
The Reverend Billy Graham has died. He was 99. He died at his home in Montreat, North Carolina this morning. Graham was a world-famous evangelist. He preached directly to millions in more than 400 crusades for more than 60 years. And through television and radio, it's estimated his sermons were heard by more than 2 billion people. He was also known as America's pastor, as well as the pastor of presidents. Jeff Tabiri from member station WUNC looks back at Graham's life.
William Franklin Billy Graham, Jr. was born November 7, 1918, in Charlotte, North Carolina. He was the first of 4 children raised by strict Calvinists on a dairy farm. When he was 15, Graham heard evangelist Mordecai Ham speak about sin. The message connected with Graham. After high school, he went to Bob Jones College in Tennessee, transferred to the Florida Bible Institute, and became ordained as a Southern Baptist minister in 1939. Roger Payne is the chair of religious studies at UNC Asheville. He says Graham became a well-known evangelist while working with Youth for Christ, an organization with many fundamentalist founders.
But Graham himself really moved very quickly out of that fundamentalist background and really came to embrace a broader stream of sort of conservative evangelical Protestantism.
By 1949, Graham had built a following. He scheduled a crusade in Los Angeles and received significant national attention from one particular newspaper chain.
The story is that William Randolph Hearst instructed his reporters to puff Graham, and so he became a national figure shortly after that time.
Payne also credits Graham's success with oratory execution and historical timing.
Living under the shadow of Soviet atomic weaponry, with the beginning of the Cold War, with the idea that Graham espoused a number of times that communism was a counterfeit religion established by Satan, all of those things really fed into a certain view of the world, a certain theology, a certain way of acting that I think really helped propel Graham into the national spotlight.
And if Jesus Christ had to pray all night, what about us? In 1958, with our race problem, with our problem of communism, with the problem of crime that is getting worse with every passing day, with all the social problems that we face in the world, and the personal problems, and the problem of sin, we Americans are not praying. We're not calling upon God.
You know, he's one of the great communicators of all time.
Historian and UNC Asheville professor Dan Pierce.
Some might characterize him as a salesman, but I think if he's selling, it was something that he, definitely believes in himself.
Graham's legacy includes TV specials and meetings at the White House. He met every U.S. president dating back to Harry Truman. During the Dwight Eisenhower administration, Graham was a regular White House visitor, where he became close friends with then-Vice President Richard Nixon. In 2002, recorded phone conversations between Graham and Nixon were released. In a conversation about religious relations, the two discussed Mark Tenenbaum, a well-respected rabbi who Graham was getting ready to meet with.
Well, the thing that you've really got to emphasize to him, though, Billy, is this anti-Semitism is more stronger than we think, you know. They just, it's unfortunate, but this has happened to the Jews, happened in Spain, it's happened in Germany, it's happening, and now it's going to happen in America if these people don't start behaving.
Well, you know, I told you one time that the Bible talks about two kinds of Jews. One is called the synagogue of Satan. They're the ones putting out the pornographic literature. They're the ones putting out these obscene films.
Graham was 83 when those tapes were released. He said he didn't have any recollection of the conversation, but apologized for the remarks. In his later years, Graham remained a public figure, but in a much more infrequent capacity. There were big parties to mark his 90th and 95th birthdays.
Happy birthday.
Observers couldn't help but notice who was on the guest list. Historian Dan Pierce.
It looked like more of a partisan event than you would expect in some ways. And I think particularly the presence of Donald Trump and Sarah Palin.
In recent years, as Billy's son Franklin has led the organization, some say the association has aligned itself with the neoconservative political right. Franklin said the message and focus of the organization have remained steady. Scholars like Professor Payne say we will probably never know for certain whether what has been perceived as a shift in philosophy by the organization was driven by Billy or Franklin. Regardless of how the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association has been viewed in recent years, the founder remained a beloved figure for countless people. His words provided hope to many during the best and worst of times. He spoke at the Washington Cathedral days after the 9/11 attacks.
I've been asked hundreds of times in my life why God allows tragedy and suffering. I have to confess that I really do not know the answer, totally, even to my own satisfaction. I have to accept by faith that God is sovereign and he's a God of love and mercy and compassion in the midst of suffering.
Billy Graham was 99. For Here and Now, I'm Jeff Tiberi.
Now to Germany, where an unusual therapy for dementia is yielding some surprising results for senior citizens. A nursing home in Dresden takes patients on a simulated trip back to a country that no longer exists, communist East Germany. NPR's Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson reports.
On this recent morning, a dozen residents at the Alexa nursing home here in Dresden are busy exercising, but they aren't working their muscles. They are firing up their brains. For Eleanor Bellmann, that involves ironing tablecloths, one after the other. The activity evokes memories in the 84-year-old, and she tells me how she took care of her husband and home here long ago. Sitting nearby is Gerda Nowak. She looks perplexed.
Sitzen bleiben.
The 93-year-old keeps asking, where am I supposed to go? Bellmann tells her to stay seated. But nursing home director Gunther Wolfram has a better idea. He suggests to Nowak they visit the local Intershop, like people here used to do when Dresden was part of the GDR, or German Democratic Republic. The state-run general stores are long gone, but a mock-up is only a few steps away from where the elderly woman is sitting. Wolfram says for dementia patients like Nowak, this trip down memory lane helps her escape from a mental prison that the newer, unified Germany can't unlock. That's because most of the memories these patients still have are of the past. Nowak searches the Intershop shelves for familiar products. Her face lights up each time she recognizes one. Like the shopping bag Wolfram holds for her, made out of a polyester fabric called Dederon, a name based on how GDR is pronounced in German.
Das war ein kleiner Pfennige.
They also joke about the Alufenige he's holding. That's the nickname for the lightweight East German pennies that, like all GDR currency, weren't worth much.
Alu-ships, no.
The store is in what Wolfram calls a remembrance room. There are two in his nursing home, each one filled with East German-made furniture, appliances, and other items from the 60s and 70s that the residents would have had at home or work. The rooms expand on a widely practiced treatment for dementia known as memory therapy. Experts say it's not a cure, but it can increase cognitive skills and a patient's independence.
Was wahrscheinlich wesentlich besser funktioniert, ist diese, diese
Wolfram says residents here do better when they are immersed in former East German culture. It's something Wolfram discovered 2.5 years ago after he bought a 60s-era motor scooter built in East Germany as a decoration for the nursing home.
Also sie sind dabei stehen geblieben, ja.
They crowded around it and they started telling stories about how they used to ride with their girlfriends and how they used to have to stand up while driving the scooters because the seats got too hot. These stories were coming from people who had severe dementia and had rarely spoken before then.
But some German dementia experts have reservations about segregating residents into memory rooms. Dr. Vera Holthoff-Detto, a top psychiatrist in Berlin, is one of them. She says it's better to keep seniors suffering from early to middle stage dementia together with healthy residents, for example, in a music workshop.
A lot of people with dementia are very good in singing and in remembering the lines and having a wonderful voice. And in everyday life, they're not even able to really prepare a breakfast for themselves. And when they are seen by people without dementia in their capacities in music, they get a very different relationship to those people.
She says having a mixed community in a retirement home is beneficial not only to those with dementia, but to healthy seniors as well. Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson, NPR News.
There's been an unusual amount of activity coming from Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election and possible collusion with members of the Trump campaign. The indictments of 13 Russians and 3 Russian companies on Friday. Yesterday, a guilty plea from Alex van der Zwaan, a London-based lawyer and son-in-law of a Russian oligarch. Van der Zwaan admitted to lying to the FBI about contact he'd had with Rick Gates, that's the former Trump campaign associate, who pled not guilty in October to conspiracy fraud and money laundering. For more, we're joined by NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing in Washington. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jeremy.
And just today, we've got more charges to talk about. Tell us about them.
Yeah, that's right. According to what we understand is taking place in federal court today, there are new documents in the case involving Manafort and his business partner, Rick Gates. The material, as you and I are talking right now, remains under seal, so we don't know exactly what it says, what that could mean for the case that's going against those two men. But there are also press reports, as you and I are talking, that there may be some new allegations against Manafort and related potentially to his taxes or potentially to some home loans that he may have asked for during 2016. So this is very much an active matter, as the feds like to say, and the story could change again by the end of the day or by tomorrow.
Well, what do we know about yesterday's guilty plea? This is Alex van der Zwaan. Who is he and what's the significance of that?
This Mr. van der Zwaan is an attorney who is Dutch, who lives in London, and he worked for an American law firm that was brought in to do some work by Paul Manafort during the time that he and his business partner, Rick Gates, were working on behalf of political organizations in Ukraine. Van der Zwaan helped work on a report that had to do with some Ukrainian politics that, again, involved Manafort and Gates. And what federal investigators said is that he did not tell them the truth about the context he had had with Gates last year. And so the feds were able to prove that, in fact, he was lying to them. That's a crime. And the guilty plea that they concluded with him said that he acknowledged that, in fact, he had these contacts with Gates, who's Manafort's partner, and that he will face some kind of sentence for that in the near term, as much as 6 months. But he also may not get much time if he's cooperating with investigators.
And how related is that to Russian interference in the election?
Well, it's a couple of steps away from the main narrative. We're kind of in one of the spin-out subplots of the story as opposed to the main thread. But Manafort and Gates had these relationships with Ukrainian political leaders and Ukrainian entities. One of the entities involved with von der Zwan is this Ukrainian Alpha Bank, which has contact with Russian President Vladimir Putin and the leaders of Russia. It isn't clear, as you and I are talking today, exactly how that thread might tie back with these campaigns of active measures the Russians were waging against the United States, except to say that all these people are in this cast of characters with connections to Ukrainian political leaders and through them to Russian political leaders. So we don't know exactly how the equation will balance out, except to say that each one of these people is involved somehow, even if it's one or two steps removed.
Manafort and Gates both pled not guilty. Have there been reports now that Gates may change his plea? What are you hearing about that?
That's right. Our colleague, Carrie Johnson, who covers the Justice Department, has been in court recently and been following this very closely. And right now, that still has not officially happened. But because, as we said at the top here, there's some new material in the court records in Washington here, and because there's this body language involving some press reports and the actions by the attorneys who are working on this case for Gates, that's something that could happen at any time now. We don't exactly know what it would mean for Manafort's case if, in fact, Gates changes his plea. But what it could mean is that if he testifies against Manafort, that could make Manafort's legal situation even more precarious and could create an incentive for him to change his plea as well and try and take a deal from the special counsel's office in order to give them something that they may want about other people involved with this matter. But we're not there yet. That's only something that might happen two or three steps down the road.
Well, does all of this activity in the last week indicate to you that Mueller is about to do even more, that there be maybe more charges coming, that this could reach higher up in the Trump campaign?
You know, the only one who really knows the answer to that question is Mueller himself and his investigators and attorneys inside the special counsel's office. I know a lot of people had their jaws on the floor on Friday when he released this huge indictment. I think it was 37 pages against the 13 Russian individuals and three Russian entities who they accused of having done this very broad campaign of agitation on social media in the United States in 2016. And the granularity of detail that was in that indictment was really eye-watering. There was individual names of people and them sending personal emails after they had stepped out of work in St. Petersburg, and all of that was being collected by the U.S. intelligence community, and all of it was documented in this indictment. So there's a great deal more behind the scenes that the special counsel's office knows and has, and right now only they have a clear sense about what form it's going to take in terms of future action or future indictments.
But they talked on Friday about unwitting Americans, meaning that maybe the people that they were communicating with didn't even know that they were Russian.
That's possible. But there's a great deal more time left to run, most likely, in this investigation. So we may learn more about whether there were any Americans who did have winning contact or right, whether all of them were just victims, essentially.
It's NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing. Phil, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.